This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 37 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and joining me today, as he always does, is my co-host Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be talking about essential Trek philosophy from Season 7 of Deep Space Nine. Mike, are you ready to talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine?
I'm always ready to talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but I have to say, Zachary, we've been doing, this is our third, I believe, installment of essential philosophy. As we mentioned before in previous episodes, we decided to do it a little differently than most of the hosts on Trek FM do their essentials. We decided to go backwards. And so we find ourselves in Season 7 of Deep Space Nine. And while Season 7 of Deep Space Nine is a great season, I mean, it starts out with an introduction to Esri Dax with Imogen the Sand, and it ends by wrapping up the Dominion War arc in What You Leave Behind. And so this season of Deep Space Nine is very, very strong, but it's more psychological than it is philosophical. So it was really difficult for me to come up with five essential philosophy episodes and a couple of honorable mentions to throw in there, because after all, you know, there's this 8-episode arc. Nearly the entire back half of the season is intended to wrap up that Dominion War story and the series as a whole. So it's really hard for me to mine out some really good philosophical episodes, at least things that, you know, haven't been covered elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that pretty much sums up my thoughts on the overall Season 7 of Deep Space Nine. Even though I love the season, and I think it does a great job of wrapping up the overall Deep Space Nine story, I found that it was really difficult to find philosophical episodes in this season that really capture the philosophical issue to a T. I think my problem with this season from a philosophical standpoint is that almost any philosophical issue that the season touches on is really touched upon somewhere else in the Star Trek universe to a better degree, with a couple of exceptions that we're going to talk about. But Mike, before we get started too far, do you want to explain sort of our ground rules on essential Trek philosophy, how we've been proceeding with this type of Metatrek
show?
Well,
as I mentioned previously, Zachary, we are going in reverse. So if you're wondering, wow, have they done the first 6 seasons of Deep Space Nine? We have not. We started with the most recent iteration of Star Trek, Enterprise. We did Season 4, and then we covered Season 7 of Voyager, and now we're on Season 7 of Deep Space Nine. And you and I are compiling lists of about 5 episodes and a couple of honorable mentions that we feel has a strong philosophical bent to it. And we don't share our lists. I don't know what your list is. You don't know what mine is. We haven't talked about these prior to. So there may be some similarities in our lists, and there may be some differences. And as we have done previously, we have agreed and disagreed on some of these episodes and at least the philosophical content in them. As always, we encourage our listeners to jump in on the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Find our show thread on Season 7, Deep Space Nine, Essential Philosophy, and tell us what your favorites are and why. We'd love to hear from you.
Like we said a minute ago, Mike, I actually found it really challenging to pick five episodes from this season. I actually had a list of nine, and I struggled to whittle it down to five. So I did end up with five top picks and four honorable mentions, and it'll be interesting to compare our lists and see where we agree and where we disagree on this season seven of Deep Space Nine.
Well, shall we dive in? We'll go ahead and... How about you go first?
Well, Mike, before we dive in, we should say that we do Essential Trek Philosophy a little different than our normal MetaTreks episodes. Normally on MetaTreks, we try to do a deep dive into a particular episode or a particular philosophical issue or topic in philosophy. But for Essential Trek Philosophy, we're not trying to go really in depth on any one of these episodes. We're just trying to give the highlights from the overall season. So if you're looking for the essential philosophical Trek episodes from a particular season of Star Trek, you know exactly where to go. And we're going to do a deep dive into these episodes and these topics elsewhere in much more depth on other episodes of MetaTreks. But for Essential Trek Philosophy, we're trying to take the shotgun approach and cover as many of the high points as we can in the overall season.
Absolutely. So, Zachary, what's your first pick?
So my first pick, and this is absolute top of my list, the one that was I would consider an easy pick in this season, is the episode When It Rains. And if you remember the episode When It Rains, this is where we first find out that that Odo has been infected by Section 31 to spread an infection, a fatal infection, to the Founders. And what I love about this episode philosophically is just that it plays with this issue of consequentialist ethics. You know, how far are we willing to go? How much harm are you willing to cause to an individual, or even in this case, it's a type of genocide to a species as a whole, all for the sake of achieving some sort of overall good, in this case, an end to the war with the Dominion.
Yeah, that was actually one of my, I actually had 10 episodes, and I whittled that down to five essential philosophies and two honorable mentions. So that was actually really low on my honorable mention list. And for the same reason, I felt it was a nice dive into consequentialism. It's really interesting because it just really tackles that how far are you willing to go? How far is too far? And I found that very fascinating. But there are actually several episodes in this season of Deep Space Nine that really deal with that in different ways. It seems to be a recurring theme in season seven.
I think what I like about this particular telling of the story is oftentimes there's a clear sort of the consequences are really clear. Like if you know, do a certain action that's going to prevent a war and that's going to save billions of lives. In this case, the infecting the Founders with a fatal disease amounts to a type of genocide. So as I kind of weigh the consequences that are at play in this episode in my mind, you've got all the potential lives that are going to be saved or lost as a result of the War of the Dominion versus the total number of Founders that there are. And it becomes kind of a numbers game, you know, which way do you go to save the maximum number of lives? And is it really worth what amounts in my mind to a genocide? And I think, as I see it, the ethical dilemma here in When It Rains is somewhat similar to the ethical dilemma in the episode In the Pale Moonlight. In that episode, if you remember, Captain Sisko has to face a dilemma of, you know, basically what amounts to killing a Romulan to draw the Romulans into the war. And it's a matter of one person's life versus, you know, the many millions or billions of lives that are going to be saved as a result of stopping the war with the Dominion. But this episode, I think it's a little harder because the dilemma at play in this episode is essentially a type of genocide. You know, should the Federation be willing to commit genocide against the Founders for the sake of preventing a war? And I don't think that's as clear cut of an ethical dilemma, even from a consequentialist standpoint, as in The Pale Moonlight.
So, not in any particular order, Zachary. I'm going to go ahead and throw one of mine out simply because it's related to When It Rains, and that is Extreme Measures. Again, I wouldn't call this my top pick, certainly not, but definitely on my list. Extreme Measures, Zachary, of course, is the episode in which Dr. Bashir manages to lure Luther Sloan, the operative from Section 31, that we met in actually prior to When It Rains, but he made several appearances in Deep Space Nine. When It Rains was one of those. And so he lures Luther Sloan to Deep Space Nine in order to get out of him the antidote to the virus that was created to cause the genocide of the Founders. And so in the course of interrogating Sloan, Sloan attempts to commit suicide. And so Bashir and O'Brien decide to take, extreme measures to try and extract that information from him. And what I really like about this episode, again, you're dealing with consequentialist ethics. How far is too far? How far are you willing to go? In fact, there's a conversation that takes place between Bashir and O'Brien. Dr. Bashir says, "Romulan mind probes are not the most pleasant of devices, but they're very efficient." And Sloan says, "They're also illegal in the Federation." And Dr. Bashir says to Sloan, "Oh, I hope you can appreciate the irony of that statement." So he's basically, you know, he and O'Brien have cooked up this idea that, you know, if we can't get it out of you willingly, we'll use Romulan mind probes. In other words, we're willing to break the law in order to extract the information that we need to save our friend. So really strong leaning towards consequentialist ethics. But it also, this episode explores a little bit, I think, the nature of consciousness, because they kind of go on a journey inside Sloan's mind, if you will. And Sloan's mind, of course, kind of takes on the persona of the space station, Deep Space Nine, and they're moving through the corridors, they're going through different rooms, they're going through file cabinets, and these, of course, are the essential pieces of knowledge that Sloan has collected over the years. It is, in essence, Section 31. So I thought it was a really neat, interesting dive into the nature of consciousness as well.
Well, I got to say, Extreme Majors was also on my list, so I'm going to cross that one off my list as well. I didn't put it on my list for the consequentialist reasons. I think you're right. In general, this season has kind of a consequentialist bent to it. You know, how far should, Federation members be willing to go to end the Dominion War? And in one way or another, that's the persistent theme and the ethical dilemmas in this season. But I was really fascinated by this look inside Sloan's mind. I mean, you know, it's an interesting dramatic question, first of all. If you're going to depict the inside of someone's consciousness, how are you going to do that visually on screen? And I think it's fascinating to use Deep Space Nine and the metaphors that you described, file cabinets and drawers and rooms and corners, to describe, you know, the structure and the contents of the information and the knowledge inside one's mind. So I think that's fascinating. And of course, you know, I think whenever there's an issue of these conjoined consciousness, or someone visiting someone else's consciousness, whether it's a Vulcan mind meld, whether it's an empathic or telepathic connection, whether it's a Romulan mind probe, whatever the technology or the device is, it's an interesting question of what's the phenomenology of that? What is it? What is the experience of sharing someone's consciousness or visiting someone else's mind? You know, clearly the rest of us don't have direct experience of this. This is something we have to leave to fiction and drama and storytelling. But if that were possible, it's a fascinating hypothetical question. What would consciousness be like if it were shared with another being? And I should say that Deep Space Nine in general has this as a theme, starting all the way with the introduction of Lieutenant Dax, with being a Trill with a combined consciousness of a host and a symbiont. Mm-hmm. There's an inherent question of what is the nature of this conjoined consciousness, and what is that like? And that's a theme that is explored in various ways throughout Deep Space Nine. I think finally culminating in this, last swan song for this issue of in philosophy about consciousness and the nature of conjoined or shared or visited consciousness inside Deep Space Nine. This is really one. It's for me, philosophically, it's one of the highlights of the season, because generally this season, like we said, is very heavy on ethics and political philosophy and consequentialist ethics, given that we're smack in the middle of a war with the Dominion at this point, you know, creeping up on being at the end of the war. But, I love that this season, even with all of that drama going on, still takes the time to explore this interesting question about the nature of shared consciousness. So this is for me, is one of the highlights of season 7 philosophically.
Yeah, in fact, I have to say it was a very Star Trek approach to this question, too. The fact that, yes, they had the rooms and the corridors and the file cabinets and, you know, the different pads with knowledge, with information on them. So that was a lot of fun. But Zachary, one of the things that really I think I kind of tuned into was the fact that you had different facets of Sloan. At one point, Bashir and O'Brien are having a conversation with this, you know, very you know, very polite, very nice Luther Sloan. He's willingly going to give up the information. He's introducing them to his family and his friends who have all gathered here for this moment where he apologizes for, you know, living his entire life inside of himself and not giving of himself and sharing of himself with his family and friends. And I thought that was really interesting. But just as he's about to give up the information, because after all, this is, you know, this is a nice Luther Sloan. Another Luther Sloan shows up and shoots him. I love this scene just for the comedy relief. You know, Chief O'Brien says, "Julian," and Bashir says, "Don't look at me for explanations." I really appreciate the comedy there. But what an interesting exploration into the different facets of somebody's consciousness, not just the consciousness as a whole, but the fact that we are all different versions of ourselves as the need arises.
I thought you were going to say we were all a little schizophrenic. Well, frankly, Mike, that squares with my experience of consciousness. I mean, I have an interior monologue, and I often have what I would describe, for lack of a better term, as interior dialogues with myself. You know, different facets of my personality, or different approaches, different parts of my temperament, different desires, different whatever. You know, there's an ongoing sort of interior battle or debate or discussion between these different facets, none of which gets expressed outward very much. And that, so this really does kind of square with my sense of consciousness. You know, I have a certain vision of myself, and I've got other parts of my consciousness that are in tension with that narrative I tell about myself. And I'm just curious, does this square up with your experience of consciousness? I think this captures the complexity of human consciousness fairly well.
So what you're saying to me is that there's a room inside your mind that you gather, you talk to yourself, you have pads with national secrets on them, Section 31 maybe? Zachary, are you Section 31? Do you know what Section 31 is?
I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might serve to incriminate me.
Not to speak is to speak, my friend.
Right. Well, you'll just have to get a Romulan mind probe and find out.
I will, to answer your question, I can say that that does square up with my own understanding of consciousness. I too have in their dialogue, as I think most people do. We see it often depicted in cartoons as a devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other, and sometimes that's just depicted as the individual and you know, this kind of back and forth tug of war. And so I thought this was really interesting because it took the angel and the devil off the shoulder and it put them in a space station, and you got to see that tug of war, I think, in a more realistic sense. You know, the good, and I won't exactly call evil Sloan, but that's certainly the imagery that you're given there. You're given the imagery of a good Sloan and an evil Sloan, one who's willing to give up the secret to save Odo and to benefit O'Brien and Bashir, and then certainly one who is willing to commit murder in order to suppress that information. So I found it interesting. It does, in some sense, jive with my own experience.
And I think it squares with my sense that, you know, almost everyone, no matter what they do, even people who commit evil in the world, think of themselves as doing good. And you can see this in the depiction of Sloan. You know, Sloan is willing to do some pretty terrible things as a member of Section 31. On the other hand, he really does, there's a part of him that really does see himself as Sloan, the family man, as a good guy with good motivations that everyone likes. And that's a part of his inner narrative that he tells about himself, about who he is.
There's a really interesting conversation that takes place between Sloan and Bashir, in which Sloan gives Julian a read of who he thinks he is. And Sloan says to Bashir, he says, I misread you. I thought that you were just a misguided idealist, but you're really a dangerous man. And so there's this really interesting psychological aspect to it. But again, this dive into the nature of consciousness, the fact that Bashir and O'Brien were able to be injured while they were in there. I thought that was fascinating. We know that that's actually a documented phenomenon in which people will experience a wound as a result of something they were dreaming because of the severity of the imagery that's being processed by their minds. Their body reacts to it in some way.
Yeah, this is something I don't know very much about, Mike, but it strikes me that it's related in some way to psychosomatic illnesses, that whatever's going on in your mental experience has some impact on, you know, the health or the well-being or the experience of your physical body. And again, that itself raises an interesting philosophical question about how, you know, something going on at the mental level can have an impact at the physical level. You know, if you go like the dualist mental route, then that's really hard to explain. But at very least, it's some sort of top-down causation or some sort of deep interaction between whatever is going on in your brain and how it's related to your physical body in ways that we don't really fully understand, frankly. But that, it's a fascinating take on the relationship between mind and body, given that there seems to be some sort of causal relationship, in universe.
Yeah, just another reason why I definitely think that this is essential philosophy for season 7 of Deep Space Nine.
Well, Mike, talking about extreme measures is a good segue into my next pick, which is the episode After Image, which is one of the early episodes of season 7 of Deep Space Nine. And if you remember, After Image is the episode where we first get a deep dive into a look at the character of Ezri, who is the next host of the Dax symbiont. So we're introduced to Ezri Dax. And even though we do get a couple of episodes with Ezri before we get After Image, in the episode of After Image, you can see the writers attempting to explore this question of what it means for a new host to take over a symbiont. So I think philosophically, Mike, what I like about the episode After Image is that it continues this exploration of the question of joint consciousness or shared consciousness that we see throughout Deep Space Nine. And we see it a couple of times in season 7. We saw it in Extreme Measures when we looked at O'Brien and Bashir's dive into the consciousness of Sloan. And now we see it with a new host of the Dax symbiont and all of the experience of what that would be like to have a new host combined with a symbiont that's been around for a long time and what it means to share those experiences with a unique personality. And I think I just like the character question here. What would it mean for all of the Dax symbiont's friends from Deep Space Nine to learn to interact with a new version of Dax, Ezri Dax? And how much of the Dax character carries over from all of the previous hosts and how much is really being informed by this particular host, the Ezri character, the Ezri host of the Dax symbiont? And, you know, where's the middle ground? I struggle with this, Mike, because I feel like I don't even know how to ask the question that this episode is trying to address philosophically, mainly because I don't have any experience with shared consciousness myself, like we've observed before. So I don't know what it would be like to be conjoined with another type of being with that being's experiences combined with my experiences, that being's personality combined with my personality, and how that would manifest itself. And you can see that, you know, the Dax character throughout Deep Space Nine has this type of exploration. How much, when we had Jadzia, how much does Jadzia bring to the table versus how much the Dax symbiont brings to the table? How much of the actions of that character are accounted for by the will or the control of the Dax symbiont versus Jadzia, the host? And we can see that here with Ezri. You know, how much does Dax bring to the table versus how much, you know, new experience and new shades of meaning and new characterization does Ezri bring to the table? And again, there's no real answer to this question. It just leaves it as an open question. But I like that it plays with this notion of joint consciousness, because I think it's not clear at all. Philosophically, it just raises a bunch of interesting questions for me, like where, if you have a symbiont inside of you down in your abdomen somewhere, and, you know, the host is conscious where its brain is, up in its head somewhere, where is consciousness happening? Where is it perceived? What's the neural link? You know, there's presumably some sort of neural transfer between these two types of beings. Where does the consciousness come from? How is it shared? How much does each being contribute? You know, it raises really fascinating questions to me, but none of which are really answered inside the universe.
I had a difficulty, because we get so much of this exploration in season 7 of Deep Space Nine. We got it certainly in After Image, as you mentioned here, Image of the Sand, Shadows and Symbols. We see it again later on in the season with Prodigal Daughter, how she relates to her family. And then even later on in the season, as we see how her experience with the Dax symbiont and her memories that come to her as a result of Jadzia's joining with the Dax symbiote, and how all of that kind of informs her relationship with Worf. So there's a lot of that that kind of exploration in season seven. But honestly, Zachary, for me, I didn't really include any of those episodes on my list. And the reason I didn't is because I feel like, to some degree, we've already had that exploration, because we had six seasons of it, in fact, with Jadzia. And I'm not here to debate, you know, who wore it better, who wore the Dax symbiote better, you know, Jadzia or Ezri. I think they both brought something very interesting, I think, to the show. And I think they're both phenomenal actresses. You know, we got six seasons of Terry and, you know, only one season of Nikki. But the truth is, we've already gone through this exploration. So I just felt like it was somewhat of a rerun to some degree, all crammed into a single season. Six seasons of what we've explored with Jadzia crammed into this one season for Ezri.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, generally, these generic questions about the nature of Trill consciousness are addressed throughout Deep Space Nine. So this episode, After Image, doesn't add anything really unique from that standpoint. I think why I like this episode and why it's on my list is that it kind of explores it from a different angle. You know, when we had Jadzia for six seasons, we never really got to see the transition from one host to another in any meaningful sense, how it would affect relationships, how it would affect, you know, a relationship with Worf, how it would affect friendships, how it would affect the relationship with Captain Sisko. And here we finally get to see a Trill in transition, not just for an episode, but for an entire season, right? We get to see, you know, what it's like for the host to adapt to this new joint consciousness, and what it means for all of her friends and family to adapt to this change as well. And I like that it just dwells on the change. You know, I think when the Trill are dealt with in this way elsewhere, I'm thinking back to when the Trill are first introduced in Star Trek: The Next Generation. There was an episode of The Next Generation where a Trill is injured and then has to get a new host. And we get to see kind of that transition for an hour on screen, but we don't get to see the long-term consequences and what that transition is really like. And I like that this episode really forces this question of, well, what is it like to be a Trill going through this experience? Not necessarily from a metaphysical standpoint, from a social interactivity standpoint, but in my mind, that's still philosophically relevant. I mean, think how much of our consciousness and how much of our experience is tied up with our relationships with other people, how much of our self-identity is tied up with our relationships with other people. So in my mind, this question of what's it like for Ezri/Dax to go through this transition is very relevant to the question of personal identity. And I like that this episode really dwells on it for, and season seven overall dwells on this question more than we've seen previously in Star Trek, even with Jadzia over six seasons.
I got to push back just a little bit on that, because I really feel like, yeah, this is definitely a crucible of sorts, because we kind of get this little capsule of, again, what I think we saw over six seasons. You had mentioned that we don't really get to see how the relationships are affected, when in fact, I think we do, because really early on in those first several episodes of Deep Space Nine season one, we really see the relationship between her and Benjamin Sisko, because we didn't just change from one female host to another. We changed from a male host to a female host, and not just any male host, but somebody that Benjamin Sisko really looked to as a father figure. Curzon was kind of the crazy uncle that Sisko had, that, you know, took him to a Ryzen bar and got him drunk. And they have these stories, these crazy things that they did. And now this crazy old guy that he used to hang out with, that took him on these crazy adventures, is now a beautiful young woman who is under his command. And so I think we had that exploration to some degree. And again, this over six seasons. But the benefit here, and I think you're right, the benefit here is we kind of get to see that genesis in a single season, somewhat of a crucible or capsule.
And maybe the difference for me is that I just care more about this transition. When we're first introduced to Jadzia, we didn't really know Curzon. We didn't have any emotional attachment to him. And we've spent six seasons of Deep Space Nine at this point getting emotionally attached to Jadzia as a character, right? And she's very familiar. We know lots about her. We care about her as a character, as fans. And losing that character and gaining a new character, I think there's just a bigger emotional stake for us, the viewer. Again, that's not terribly relevant philosophically. That's not a reason to necessarily to put this on the list. I mean, inherently, I think the issues are interesting, but I think it's a better exploration in my mind because we do care about that. We care about the transition more than we cared about the transition from Curzon to Jadzia.
I really think, and listeners, we'd love to invite you to chime in on this. I really think that Dax would be a great, great exploration for us to take on sometime on Metatrax. I'd love to see what our listeners think of that. If you'd like to chime in and tell us what you think, would you like to see an exploration of Dax, be it Curzon or Jadzia or Ezri, all of the above? We can even go back further than that and explore this character, because I think there's really a lot to be understood, and I think there's a lot that if you're not thinking in a philosophical way, you really miss what this character means to the overall Star Trek story and its mission to explore the human condition through the lens of science fiction.
I think, Mike, you make a really interesting point that oftentimes in Star Trek in general, these philosophical issues are explored one episode at a time, right? There's an episode on a particular time travel episode or a particular episode about personal identity. But just as Deep Space Nine, from a dramatic standpoint, has long story arcs, I think you get what I would call philosophical story arcs in Deep Space Nine. And this long-term exploration of the nature of consciousness and shared consciousness and what it means to have those experiences as a character like Dax, that is an attempt to not just deal with these philosophical issues in a one-off episodic kind of way, but really to take a fundamental premise or an idea and run with it for seven seasons. And I think you can see that in the Dax character. You know, there's this interesting premise. What if there was this species that had a joint consciousness, a host and a symbiont? Well, what would that mean? Well, we can spend an episode on that, and Star Trek The Next Generation does that very well in that episode I mentioned with the Trill. But in Deep Space Nine, you get seven seasons of what it's like to be a Trill, what it's like to have a joint consciousness. So I think there's just a depth to Deep Space Nine's exploration of these issues that you don't get in the other more episodic series of Star Trek.
Indeed. So I definitely think we should put it on the calendar, do an episode of Metatrex on Dax's new digs.
But my question, Mike, is which Dax? Are we going to cover the Russian epic of Cinderella? Or are we going to do the Dax scene in Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country? Or we want to stick with the Trill version?
I think we should stick with the Trill version.
I was looking forward to talking about the Russian epic of Cinderella.
It amazes me how sometimes we'll see these names pop up in Star Trek. For instance, we had an Admiral Chakotay. I love how they recycle these names from time to time and throw them back in new and exciting ways. Just a little side note there. Well, Zachary, I'm going to throw my next pick out. And for this pick, I chose this because I think it is a great exploration of the philosophy of religion. It's one of those, just as much as season seven explores the Dax character a lot, I think we get a really great exploration of Nog as a character. Nog is one of my favorite characters inside of Star Trek. We got to see him grow up. We got to see him transition from being a quintessential young Ferengi boy to doing something that no Ferengi had ever done, and that's join Starfleet, and how that affected him in his adult life. And so I chose Treachery, Faith, and the Great River as one of my picks, again, because it explores the philosophy of religion and, of course, the great material continuum. We get to see Nog be a little bit of a guru. He's teaching Chief O'Brien a thing or two. He's got his own ways of doing things. He's finagling and wheeling and dealing and trading and bartering, and it's all going to be okay. You just have to have faith in the great material continuum. But as this is going on, and I'm not really sure which is the A plot and which is the B plot in this, because they both are equally strong storylines, while all of this is going on, we get to explore a little bit about the relationship, the unique relationship between the Founders and the Vorta. And as Weyoun Six has chosen to defect, which I think in and of itself raised some interesting philosophical questions in this episode, we get some really great conversations between Odo and Weyoun Six that really give a peek into at least one of the philosophies I think surrounding the idea of religion. So I thought this was a really fascinating episode. And of course, we get Rule of Acquisition 168, which is whisper your way to success. So Zachary, you can whisper, or you can say it loud. You're a successful philosopher. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think what I love about the way aliens in general are portrayed in Star Trek is that generally the aliens in Star Trek are metaphors for we humans here in the real world. So all of the imperfections and the struggles and the quirks and the sometimes virtues, but oftentimes failings that we see in the way that other species and races are portrayed in Star Trek are really mirrors back at the human condition. So in general, I like any of the Ferengi stories because they really portray this materialistic nature of mankind here in the real world. Sometimes it's virtues, and you mentioned some of the virtues that are depicted inside that episode, treachery, faith, and the Great River. And that's actually an interesting dovetail into one of my picks. One of my picks, also having to do with Ferengi, is the episode The Dogs of War. And the reason that's on my list is that we get to see an interesting look at what progressiveness would mean for the Ferengi, for Ferenginar. You know, we get to see Quark making a mistake about possibly being handed the reins to be Grand Negus. It turns out it ends up being Rom who ends up being Grand Negus, but we basically get to see what is the future look like for a highly materialistic society like the Ferengi? And that's analogous to us. You know, if you look at the world we live in with its consumerism and its greed and our, wealth of material possessions, we are essentially the Ferengi in a lot of ways. So it's fun to see the Ferengi evolve towards a more progressive society, because in my mind, the Ferengi are just a straight up metaphor for this materialistic world that we live in today. So any of these Ferengi episodes, have some inherent meaning for me. So I love the one you identified, Treachery, Faith, and the Great River. I like The Dogs of War for very similar reasons. But this sort of dovetails into one of my honorable mentions that I'll go ahead and mention now, because, you and I have this ongoing interest in religion mm-hmm. and theology in Star Trek. And this is something that is explored in Deep Space Nine way more than in any other series of Star Trek. But one of my honorable mentions at this point was the episode Covenant, which looks at sort of the dark side of, we generally, Star Trek Deep Space Nine is really favorable towards religion in general. You know, the Bajorans are depicted very favorably with their spiritual beliefs and practices and whatnot, and it's depicted very charitably, generally. But we get to see a look into the dark side of religion and basically religious cults inside the episode Covenant. And so I that's one of my honorable mentions. I just want to mention while we're talking about religion and theology inside season 7 of Deep Space Nine, that almost made my list for that reason alone, but other episodes won out, but I think that's worth mentioning as well. So yeah, I love the episodes with the Ferengi in this season. And this season does touch on a number of different issues, including this question of the value or virtues or failings of religious belief.
Yeah, Nog in particular, again, is one of my favorite characters in Star Trek. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we got to see him grow up. I know you and I have talked several times about doing an episode of Metatrex on Ferengi virtue ethics. I think that would still be a fun episode to do, because they do have kind of an interesting take on virtue ethics that's not too far removed from the capitalist ideas that swirl around in our own society. But again, this episode, Treachery, Faith, and the Great River, also is a really interesting exploration in faith as well, because, in fact, Nog mentions several times to Chief O'Brien, he has to have faith. This is really kind of an exploration of Ferengi religion. It's Reverend Nog here at his best. He's talking about having faith in the Great Continuum. It's almost like this is the Ferengi force. You know, it encompasses all things. It surrounds all things. It binds everything together, and it's the Ferengi force.
It's almost a type of Ferengi cosmology. It's not just that they value wealth, but they've really woven it into their view of the universe at large, right? It's not just an economic exchange. It's the flow of the great material continuum. So yeah, this is an interesting look at Ferengi. I hesitate to call it religious beliefs, but at least Ferengi cosmology. They take their beliefs about economics and make those part of the fabric of the universe in their own mind.
Well, if you think about it, Zachary, even Ferengi heaven is depicted as a place of commerce. You have to buy your way in. You have to bribe your way in. So I think your word cosmology is interesting. But I mean, let's call it what it is. It's religion. And while all that's going on in Treachery, Faith, and the Great River, there's the exchanges that are going on between Odo and Wei Yun Six. I love dialogue. Anybody who listens to Metatrex has probably caught on that I'm really into dialogue. It's all about the writing for me. I like special effects. I dig the pew pew. I'm a ship geek, and I'll geek out with the best of them when it comes to ship designs and so on. But I really dig the writing and dialogue. So there's this really great exchange going on between Odo and Wei Yun Six. Odo says to Wei Yun Six, "Has it ever occurred to you that the reason you believe the founders are gods is because that's what they want you to believe? They built it into your genetic code." And Wei Yun Six doesn't give this a second thought. He says, "Well, of course they did. That's what gods do. After all, why be a god if there's no one to worship you?" And so that really raises some interesting questions, I think, philosophically, about the relationship that exists between the Weyuns, the Vorta, and the founders. And for that matter, it also raises some interesting questions about the role that religion plays in our own world. During some of those exchanges, Odo is interrogating Wei Yun Six to some degree, trying to figure out why he defected. And really, at the end of the day, the reason why Wei Yun defected was a step of faith, because he realized that he wanted to be closer to Odo. In other words, he chose to worship Odo over the rest of the changelings.
Mike, while we're talking about this, what do you think about the sort of compare and contrast between the way in which the Bajorans relate to their gods, the prophets, versus the way that the Vorta relate to their gods, the founders? Is there anything interesting we can learn in the compare and contrast amongst those two, religious beliefs?
The fascinating thing for me, and we'll take a look at the relationship between the Bajorans and the wormhole aliens. For me, the prophets are benevolent, but they're out of sight. In other words, the Bajorans have never really seen them. They're depicted in stories and their mythos and so on. But, you know, they've never really had a conversation with any of the prophets. There's never been any kind of rapport. I'm sure that there are some creation stories that exist, but it's different between the Vorta and the founders, because there is a strong creation mythos that exists, and you're kind of left with a wondering of, is this something that the founders have just told them in order to manipulate and control them? Or certainly we know from the Jemadar that the founders are very skilled with their genetic engineering ability. And so, you know, perhaps they did take this lower life form, this unevolved creature, and, you know, with a few selective genes here and a few selective genes there, and they create a subservient race. But there's dialogue between them. Certainly, it's probably one of the greatest honors that that a Vorta can have, is to actually accompany and work alongside one of their gods. So there, in that regard, Zachary, I think there's a big difference between the relationship of the Vorta and the founders, and the relationship between the Bajorans and the prophets.
For the Vorta, it's not so much a question of faith, I think, right? The Vorta don't, you know, they don't have to, they're not in a position of being skeptical that their gods exist, because literally the founders are right there in front of them. It's more a question of interpreting what they've already experienced, right? You know, they see the founders, they have lots of experience with them, they interpret them as being their gods. But there's no question that they exist or that they're real. And I think there could be a genuine question that wormhole aliens, if you haven't had direct experience of them, say with an orb experience, or like Captain Sisko having direct experience with them in the wormhole, there's a genuine question, do they really exist? Just like us for today, there's a real question, does a divine being or a god exist? Well, if we don't have direct experience of it, then it's a question of faith and it's a question of belief. But it doesn't seem like the Vorta have that issue in relation to the founders.
And something else that we haven't even really mentioned is the relationship between the Ferengi and their religion. Just as the Jewish people, I think, were beholden to the Torah, I think we see the relationship between the Ferengi and their religion, that conduit, if you will, Zachary, being the rules of acquisition. It's a rules-based religion.
Well, see, Mike, this is why we need to do another episode of Metatreks on Ferengi ethics, because it's not clear at all to me if the Ferengi's ethics is fundamentally a virtue-based ethics or if it's a rule-based ethics, because they do have the rules of acquisition, or does their ethics fundamentally center more on Ferengi character traits like you'd experience in virtue ethics. I'm not really sure about that. It sounds like a topic for another episode of Metatreks. But while we're talking about Ferengi, I did have another thought about the episode that I had mentioned. One of my picks was the Dogs of War. Mm-hmm. And insofar as Rom is an unlikely candidate for Grand Negus, in my mind, this is a great example of the paradox of the Philosopher King, that the people who are best prepared to be a leader and the most qualified and would do the best job often don't seek positions of power. And I like that the way that being Grand Negus is kind of unexpectedly thrust upon Rom at the end of this episode, because it just speaks to this issue of, he's a great leader for a progressive new Ferengi that gets beyond the rules of acquisition and Ferengi, Ferenginar as we've known it. But he doesn't seek position of power, and power has to be kind of thrust upon him, as it's thrust on many great leaders in the history of our own world. Hopefully Rom will take that and do great things with it and make Ferenginar a more progressive world than we've seen it, at any point in the Star Trek universe. But in my mind, the Ferengi episodes, like I said, they're great metaphors for us. But this episode, The Dogs of War, is a really interesting example of Plato's paradox of the Philosopher King.
And we should mention, Zachary, that we did talk a good deal about that in Metatreks episode 15, in fact, entitled The Philanthropist Negus. So listeners, go back and check that one out if you haven't heard it before.
Yeah, and while we're talking about it, I want to squeeze one more honorable mention, and I hate to put my honorable mentions before my actual picks, but I'm going to, because we're talking about the actual topic. Another interesting look at the paradox of the Philosopher King is the episode Tacking Into the Wind. And it's the episode where Worf basically turns down the opportunity to be leader of the High Council. After having killed Gowron, right? Mm-hmm. After having killed Gowron, Worf basically turns down the opportunity to be leader of the High Council. And I think almost anyone would think that Worf would make an incredible leader of the High Council. And when the mantle is finally thrust upon Martok, he doesn't want it either at first. He has to be convinced to take the mantle and be a leader of the High Council himself. So Chancellor to become Chancellor Martok. And I just like that, you know, these leaders that really would be great leaders, you know, they encapsulate the virtues of, in this case, Klingons more than almost any other Klingon we see in the Star Trek universe. And neither one of them wants to take the responsibility of being a leader. They don't seek that as an end in itself. So again, that's just another great look at the paradox of the Philosopher King inside season 7 of Deep Space Nine.
Indeed. Well, Zachary, along the theme of Ferengi, as I mentioned, Nog being one of my favorite characters, I absolutely love this particular episode for Nog, and that is It's Only a Paper Moon being one of my picks. I think this is a really fascinating episode for a lot of reasons. I think it explores medical philosophy, but I think even beyond that, we get a really interesting exploration of the character Vic Fontaine, and we explore the nature of existence and free will. There's a great dialogue going on between Nog and Vic, and Nog asks him, "When you sleep, do you dream?" You know, kind of a criteria, if you will, for consciousness, at least I think in Nog's mind. Chief O'Brien happens to mention that Vic has the ability to turn himself off, to turn himself back on. If he doesn't want to come online, he doesn't have to. And Nog asks him, so you mean he has free will? And Chief O'Brien actually says, well, I'm not a philosopher. I'm an engineer. But I think it's an interesting exploration into what again, there's a lot of psychological aspects with Nog experiencing PTSD and, you know, what he's going through, but there's a lot of interesting medical ethics questions that are being asked in this episode about how much of this fantasy should they allow him to indulge himself in, to go hide, as they said, in the holosuite. But also that interesting exploration of the Vic character and the nature of his own consciousness and free will. I think it's a very fascinating episode.
I think the thing I struggle with this season in general, and maybe a little bit of Deep Space Nine as a whole philosophically, is that so many of the interesting issues in this season of Deep Space Nine are wrapped up not just with philosophy in a narrow sense, but they're wrapped up with sociology and they're wrapped up with psychology. And there are these really interesting, deep dives into other areas of thought besides sort of strictly speaking philosophy. Yet, you're right, there are some really interesting questions raised about the status of Vic Fontaine as a person, as a conscious being. Does he have free will? Does he not? Does he dream or does he not? Is he conscious or is he not? But that's not the focus of the episode, It's Only a Paper Moon, right? The focus is mainly about the psychology of getting recovering from trauma, and that's the focus of the episode from a character standpoint and from a psychology standpoint. That's the thing I struggle with the most in Season 7 of Deep Space Nine, is that so many of the interesting issues really only touch on particular issues in philosophy, but they don't really do a deep dive into philosophy proper. Mm-hmm. They're wrapped up with all these other related issues. And these are great, deep, important issues worthy of our discussion on Metatrex, but they're not philosophy in some narrow sense. So It's Only a Paper Moon is one of my favorite episodes that's ever been on Star Trek.
Same here.
It's an amazing character development episode. It speaks to me. Anyone who's experienced trauma or trouble in life, we'll get something out of this episode. But I guess my trouble with it philosophically is that it only has the slightest touch upon the philosophical issues proper. You know, it is an interesting question whether Vic Fontaine is conscious or not, or has free will or not, but the episode doesn't dwell on it in any meaningful sense.
I concur. In fact, as I said before, I think that's one of the problems, I think, with the seventh season of Deep Space Nine. There's nothing really deep here. And oftentimes these are issues that we've explored in better ways, either earlier on in Deep Space Nine or in other Star Trek series. For instance, you know, the nature of consciousness. We've explored this quite a bit with Data, with the Doctor in Voyager. I mean, we have really explored that question. But again, for somebody who maybe in a universe out there somewhere, is more familiar with Deep Space Nine than, say, perhaps Star Trek The Next Generation or Star Trek Voyager. You know, this is an interesting exploration of those nonetheless.
It's possible that some of these issues are getting a little long in the tooth by the time Season 7 of Deep Space Nine rolls around. I mean, there's only so many ways you can tell a time travel story, and so many ways you can tell a personal identity story, and so many ways you can tell a consciousness story. And I think maybe you can see a little bit of a struggle to try to find new ways to ask these questions as Star Trek at that point had been on TV for an impressive number of years. That said, though, I think, you know, you can only do so much within any given hour, right? So there's a tension between, you know, covering philosophical issues in depth and doing the character development you want to do. And so, you know, where Season 7 of Deep Space Nine kind of struggles philosophically and touches on these issues only in, you know, fairly lightweight terms, there's a lot of character development going on. And that's part of the reason I still love this season. It's one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek, even though it's fairly lightweight philosophically, and even though the philosophical issues are only really, you know, touched upon tangentially and not really dwelt upon in any, you know, robust, you know, deep dive kind of way.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think you've done three of your picks, and I'm going to give you my last. We overlapped one, so I'm going to give you my last pick here. My last pick for essential Trek philosophy from Season 7 of Deep Space Nine is the Siege of AR-558.
Great episode.
And again, like we just observed, you know, it's not that this episode is particularly deep for the long term. You know, it's not that it covers an essential, you know, philosophical issue in depth, but it does touch upon something really unique compared to other episodes we've talked about. It explores this question of human nature in extreme conditions, right? We get to see, you know, the humans inside this episode, the Siege of AR-558, really kind of beaten down, war trodden. And what's fascinating, we've talked about the Ferengi here a bit on this episode of Metatrex, but we get to see Quark and Nog basically commenting on the human condition. You take away their creature comforts, take away their root beer, and you basically get wild beasts that are willing to, you know, to fight a war at the drop of a hat. And look at how they're acting. And it's, again, this is every time the Ferengi are commenting on these things, they're putting the mirror right back on human nature. And this look at human nature in extreme conditions is really important, because I think you can learn something about ourselves from these kinds of stories. You know, we do get to learn that, yeah, you know, we are fairly civilized in certain environments. So, you know, when we have our creature comforts, when we have our basic needs met, that you start to take away those things, and we get much more animalistic when we get outside of our normal environment. And it's, in my mind, it's very much related to Thomas Hobbes's view of man's state of nature. You take away civilization, and it basically turns into a war of everyone against everyone. Life is nasty, brutish, and short, to use a quote from Thomas Hobbes. And that's what we see in this episode of AR-558. We get to see, you know, all of the high morality of the Federation stripped away and put humans in their most basic civilization-free situation, and how do they act, and just put that on screen, and have the Ferengi there as kind of a Greek chorus to comment on it. And I just love the Ferengi commentary on man's natural state, because, we, you know, when the Ferengi were first introduced, they were introduced as warlike. They're the ones with the leather and the whips, right? And the Federation was very civilized. Here we get to see a really interesting reversal of the relationship between the Federation and the Ferengi, where it's the Federation that's looking animalistic and warlike, and like Thomas Hobbes's depiction of the state of nature in his work, and it's the Ferengi who are taking this sort of high moral ground and saying, look at how, you know, how terrible these humans are when you take away their creature comforts. And that's a fascinating reversal of the relationship between the Federation and the Ferengi in general. And like I said, it's just a fascinating, you don't get to see this side of humans in Star Trek very much. And I like that Deep Space Nine took the time to explore the worst of mankind.
Yeah,
as well.
I don't know about root beer, but I tend to get a little grouchy when people mess with my Diet Dr. Pepper. This one was actually on my list as well, Zachary, so we can check that off for both of us. And for all the reasons that you mentioned, this is a really interesting exploration of man pressed. I can't think of a better way to articulate it. You know, if you really put the pressure on, how are we going to react? How do we as, and by the way, these are supposed to be evolved human beings. I mean, we're in the 24th century, and we're somewhat evolved, and we're enlightened, and but yet this looks very familiar to anyone who's ever watched a World War II movie or a documentary. This looks very familiar, and I realize that our experience is what informs this particular look into the future, but I think it's an interesting commentary on the fact that there are just some things that won't change. And I think the conversation between Nog and Quark is very relevant. And I think that's basically what they're saying. Listen, they're wonderful, kind, generous, good people, but you know, they've not come as far as they think they have. And you put enough pressure on them, you put them in the right situation, and they're going to revert to their baser natures.
And this is something I think it's easy to take for granted philosophically. It sounds kind of obvious. You know, you take away humans' creature comforts and they get more animalistic and brutish. But I think it's in the history of philosophy, that's not obvious at all. If you look at the difference between, say, Thomas Hobbes's view of the state of nature, kind of like what we see in AR-558 as nasty, brutish, mm-hmm. and short, warlike, animalistic, versus, say, someone like Rousseau or John Locke's depiction of man's natural state, where we have natural rights and we have free will and we have a right to life and liberty. And for John Locke, it was property, but we sort of think of it more as the pursuit of happiness here in America. You know, that's a different view of man's natural state that grounds our view of human rights and whatnot than what you get in Thomas Hobbes and what you get in this depiction of mankind in the siege of AR-558. So, you know, I think the risk here is sort of oversimplifying human nature. I think this episode doesn't tell you anything very interesting. On the one hand, if you take away our creature comforts, we get violent. Okay, we knew that about mankind, but it's not obvious at all that that's man's default natural state in all cases, at all times. And certainly in the history of philosophy, that hasn't been the default assumption. There is an ongoing debate about, you know, human nature and man's natural state and whether there even is such a thing. Existentialists would deny the entire concept altogether and say it all comes down to free will, individual free will. And there is no such thing as mankind as a whole or human nature as a whole, that those kinds of things are an excuse to take responsibility off of ourselves. So I like that this episode explores the question of human nature, but I think there's a risk of finding its conclusions about human nature too easy to accept and not really respectful of the debate about that human nature in philosophy or even in other episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Well, Zachary, that leaves me with only one pick, and I do have a couple of honorable mentions that were at the top of my honorable mention list that I do want to throw out. I won't go into any great discussion on them, but I do want to give my last pick, and that is the episode Till Death Do Us Part. And there's only one reason alone that I chose this particular episode, and it is because I really feel that it is a commentary on the nature of free will versus determinism. Is Benjamin Sisko going to choose freely his path in life, or is he going to accept that his path has been determined by the prophets and that he should not go against the path that they've laid out for him? And this process that he goes through as he makes this decision, as he goes back and forth, am I going to marry Cassidy? Am I not going to marry Cassidy? Am I going to do what the prophets want me to? Or am I going to do my own thing because she makes me happy? I thought that was really interesting. It was fascinating. It was kind of a fresh way of looking at this, because you do have, again, it's my interest is theology and the role it plays in human life. And so we're seeing that and how it informs Benjamin Sisko's decisions and what is he going to. It almost seems like a strange irony. Is he going to choose to accept free will, or is he going to choose determinism?
I'm glad you mentioned this episode, Mike, because I think this episode is interesting to me on at least three different levels. One level is the level you mentioned, the level of theology. If you have a sort of a theological worldview with a divine being or a God, that any sort of predestination or a plan that's laid out, there's this interesting question of, you know, do you follow the plan or not? Do you have free will or do you not have free will? So theologically, I find this a very interesting episode, and it has a lot to say about that question. I think you can take away the theological element altogether, just ask this fundamental metaphysical question of how does the universe work? Mm-hmm. Is there one path that's laid out in the fabric of reality through laws of nature or whatnot? Or do we have the metaphysical ability to affect the course of events in the future? I think there's a non-theological, more metaphysical element to that question that you can really separate out as a distinct question about the nature of reality, whether or not there's any sort of metaphysical divine being or some sort of higher level of reality or anything like that. So, and then the third question element that I find interesting about this episode is this question of human nature. I think human nature I've observed this many times in my own life and other people's lives. I think people tend to be contrarians. The second you tell them, here's a rule, someone's going to want to break the rule. The second you say, you can't go that direction, someone's going to go that direction. So the prophet's telling Benjamin Sisko, you shouldn't follow this path, you shouldn't marry Cassidy. That, in my mind, just cements the fact that that's what he's going to want to do. And I think that rings true from a theological standpoint. You know, you can take that, you know, in Christian theology, you can take that all the way back, sure, to the fall of mankind. You know, don't eat from the tree. What happens? People eat from the tree, right? There's something about human nature that makes us want to break the rules. So if you say, here's the path you have to follow, that's going to foster in us the desire to follow a different path than that. How that's related to whether Ben Sisko really does have free will or not, or even this theological question, I'm not really sure, but I think it says something about human nature that this, in my mind, just cements the fact that Benjamin Sisko is actually going to marry Cassidy, regardless of what the prophets have to say. He's going to want to exert his own free will.
Just as mankind is innately rebellious, Benjamin Sisko has that rebellious streak as well. In fact, he doesn't really conform at all, as we see him throughout Deep Space Nine. He's really in many, many ways a nonconformist, almost from day one. We drew the contrast between his nonconformity and, say, Picard's conformity. So, you know, to see that kind of carried out in this episode, it was fascinating. I think you're right. You hit the nail on the head.
Well, any one of those issues would have made Till Death Do Us Part an essential part of Trek philosophy. But put them all together, and without a doubt, we've got to put Till Death Do Us Part Indeed. On the list today.
My two honorable mentions, Zachary, and one of the reasons why this was on my honorable mention list is we just talked about this in episode 34, Gotta Represent, and that is Take Me Out to the Holosuite. Certainly the strong leanings towards nationalism and the role that it plays in personal identity and in the identity of a culture. I think it's a fascinating exploration. I won't go into any more depth than that, other than just to remind our listeners, if you haven't heard Metatrex episode 34, Gotta Represent, go back and listen to that one. It's a really great conversation. And we get to find out what Sisko was really thinking when he was standing there looking at Solok.
So you said you had another honorable mention.
I do. I have one more, and that is Once More Unto the Breach. Apart from this being one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek altogether, I have a fascination with virtue ethics, and I really enjoy any time we get to explore Klingon virtue ethics. Again, it's a topic that you and I have taken on. We took it on very early on in our run of Metatrex. But this one particular, the thing that fascinates me about it is Kor is well past his prime. He is aged. He's old. He's probably dying. We see that he's probably getting some form of Klingon Alzheimer's disease, and he's becoming forgetful and a little foolish, at least in the eyes of the Klingons. But he still wants to contribute. He wants to die as he lived. That was his plea to Worf: "Let me die as I lived, as a warrior." And how Kor relates to the other Klingons who are around him, how they interact with him. I think there's a really interesting philosophical bent to this episode that I think can get looked over if you're not looking for it.
Mike, those are great picks for honorable mentions. Like we said at the beginning of the show, it was really hard to whittle this list down because so many of these episodes in season 7 of Deep Space Nine touch on these issues, but don't explore them in a lot of depth. So I actually have 5 really quick honorable mentions. The first one on my list is the episode Chrysalis. And in that episode, we see that one of the Doctor's genetically enhanced friends sort of gets her identity back after years of being not quite comatose, but not very communicative. And I think it's an interesting look at the question of personal identity, the question of previous experiences and how much of a core personality there is versus how much of your personality is tied with your relationships and experiences with other people and the world at large versus having a core inner personality. So Chrysalis is just an interesting look at personal identity in a unique angle that we haven't really seen in Star Trek before. I also have the episode Covenant, and I mentioned that briefly during the episode, but insofar as Deep Space Nine is willing to explore the question of spirituality and religion inside the Star Trek universe, and the Star Trek universe as a whole is often very critical of religion and spirituality, and Deep Space Nine is largely more favorable and portrays the Bajorans as very favorable given their spiritual beliefs. It treats them sympathetically. But here we get an interesting look at religious cults and the dark side of religion inside Star Trek, and I find that really, really interesting. We don't see too much of that inside Star Trek either. Third on my list of honorable mentions is the episode Field of Fire. And in this episode, we get to see Ezri Dax communicating with a former Dax host to solve a problem. There's a murder on board the space station, and we get to see Ezri sort of reconnecting with one of the past hosts of the Dax symbiont to try to solve this problem. And I like that it really tries to make the case that, you know, as people, we really do depend on the darker sides of our nature in various ways. And we can see this inside Star Trek in various ways. You know, even Captain Kirk says, "I need my pain," right? And that came immediately to mind in this episode. But I like the exploration of the relationship between Ezri and Dax and a former Dax host, Jaran, and how we rely on the darker sides of our nature to solve problems and actually end up creating some good in the world. So I find that an interesting look into human nature as well. I also have Strange Bedfellows, and this is just a very minor honorable mention. It's interesting to see Damar, a character that we have come to despise over several seasons of Deep Space Nine, become a sympathetic character and actually have something of a moral spine, have a crisis of conscience and being willing to switch allegiance. And we get to see finally the culmination of this endgame war with the Dominion, largely as a result of Damar's, you know, much late in coming, but his reemerging conscience and morals. Sense, despite the years we've spent hating Damar at this point.
It's amazing what happens when you give up Kanar.
Yeah, Damar's gone totally Puritan, you know. Now Damar would be bootlegging Kanar, I'm sure of it. If anyone would, it would be Damar, regardless of whatever improvements he's made morally and ethically and politically. He's a Kanar bootlegger. So, Mike, the last of my honorable mentions really quick is one I've already mentioned, Tacking Into the Wind, because it touches on this really important issue in political philosophy, the paradox of the philosopher king, what we expect from a good leader, and whether or not the people who are best prepared to be leaders are willing to take up the mantle and willing to seek out the power and fight the fights it takes to become a leader. And, you know, this, along with The Dogs of War, which is one of my main picks, deals with this very important issue in political philosophy, the paradox of the philosopher for King. So those are my honorable mentions. Shall we give a quick recap of all of our picks, Mike?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so for our top picks for Essential Trek Philosophy from Season 7 of Deep Space Nine, we have When It Rains, The Dogs of War, After Image, Extreme Measures, Treachery, Faith, and the Great River, It's Only a Paper Moon, The Siege of AR-558, and Till Death Do Us Part. For honorable mentions, we have Take Me Out to the Hollow Suite, we have Once More Under the Breach, we have Chrysalis, Covenant, Field of Fire, Strange Bedfellows, and Tacking Into the Wind. And that, everyone, is Essential Trek from Season 7 of Deep Space Nine. Essential Philosophical Trek.
And again, I'll say once more, just in terms of final thoughts, this was a hard season because I feel like that a lot of this particular season of Deep Space Nine was simply intended to tie up the loose threads to get the War with the Dominion wrapped up, to wrap up the character arcs for our main characters. And so it's almost as though there wasn't a lot of time or thought put in necessarily to exploring philosophy. But as you and I were able to determine, there is plenty of philosophy in here. You just have to look for it. I don't think any of it's obvious. I think oftentimes they are philosophical themes that have been explored in better ways in previous seasons and other iterations of Star Trek. So not a really strong season. But that being said, like you, this is one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek anywhere. It really gives us some of the strongest episodes. Again, the Siege of AR-558, It's Only a Paper Moon, Once More Into the Breach, Take Me Out to the Holosuite. These are favorites. These are favorite episodes among fans. That once again, the good philosophical themes that are written into these stories, albeit sometimes shallow and sometimes a little underdone, oftentimes can be looked over. And so I would just encourage, as everybody's doing the rewatches and you're going back and you're watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine, to look for these philosophical themes. And once again, I just want to encourage our listeners to tell us what your picks are. Did you agree with our picks? Do you have different picks? Do you like episodes for reasons perhaps that we didn't mention? Jump into our show thread and talk to us about it. We'd love to hear your feedback and your thoughts about Season 7 of Deep Space Nine.
Well, Mike, I don't think I have much to add for my final thoughts that we haven't already said. Like you, I struggled to find these episodes to put on my list today. I think a slightly more charitable interpretation of Season 7 of Deep Space Nine is that each of these episodes is a wonderfully crafted art piece. Not only did they manage to wrap up the Dominion War, not only did they manage to pack an awful lot of character development into this final season, but they also managed to make sure that these episodes touch on any number of different philosophical issues that we've talked about. The downside is that, you know, these episodes have to do a lot of duty, being the last season of Deep Space Nine. There were a lot of open threads that needed to be closed, some character development they wanted to see through to the end of Deep Space Nine. And it can create the appearance that these philosophical issues are tacked in there without a lot of thought. But I think a slightly more charitable reading is that really they took a lot of time to make sure that as they're doing all these other things, they're still touching on issues that are important and also the culmination of several years of philosophical thought. You know, we get to see not just one episode about consequentialist ethics, but we get to see consequentialist ethics writ large in terms of the war with Dominion over several seasons. We get to see not just one episode about Trill consciousness and joint consciousness and the nature of consciousness, but we get to see seven seasons of that as we explore the Dax character in depth, culminating in the episodes that we talked about here for season seven. So I think on the one hand, I'm a little disappointed in this season. On any particular issue, I think you can find other episodes of Star Trek that explore those issues in greater depth with more nuance. On the other hand, I'm impressed with the way in which they were able to sustain seven seasons of development on some of these issues in the long term over Deep Space Nine as a whole, culminating in season seven. So for my final thoughts, I think this season of Star Trek is definitely must-see television no matter what. It's one of my favorite seasons of Star Trek that's ever been on television. I'm a little disappointed at the philosophical content. I know part of me always wants to linger on those issues a little bit more and a little more depth, and I can go elsewhere in Star Trek to find that, but you can't beat the character development or the way in which they wrapped up the fairly complex multi-season arcs of Deep Space Nine and still managed to squeeze in some philosophy. So very, very well done, Star Trek as a whole. So those are my final thoughts. I think, if you haven't seen these episodes or haven't watched them with these philosophical issues in mind, give Season 7 of Deep Space Nine a rewatch and let us know your thoughts on the Babel Conference.
I agree, Zachary, wholeheartedly. Well, it's been a lot of fun talking about Essential Trek philosophy from Season 7 of Deep Space Nine, but as always, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look, everyone, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Please sit down, let me get my eel.
Yeah, right. It just slapped. See, now that would have been awesome if he had just, like, slapped the eel in Archer's face. And then Archer, that entire meaningful scene at the end of the episode, the discussion between Archer and T'Pol, if he had had a giant eel stuck to his body the entire time.
The orb.
And what's so great, I think, about Star Trek Deep Space Nine is, especially with Sisko, is you get to watch somebody slowly become a believer in a faith, and it's shown as being reasonable.
Literary Treks.
The big difference is when you're doing nonfiction books, we do a lot of interviewing, and the interviewing requires a lot of transcribing tapes, and that's possibly the most miserable job one could ever run into. It's a real task.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us anywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That really does help us greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows just about everywhere you can find podcasts: Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and also find us in the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not whispering your way to success, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not stocking up on root beer to keep the baser parts of human nature at bay, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs?
Well, as I said before, I prefer Diet Dr. Pepper, but you can find me certainly on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. Also, I'm on Instagram, Zachary, and there I am, cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, Norman Lau, our art director, Aaron Harvey, and our production manager, Richard Marquez. I'd also like to give a shout out to our two associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. And Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can also find her on Twitter @ChocoWeeble. We want to thank you for your support of MetaTreks and for your support of Trek FM. Well, thanks everyone for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.